Hey again, travel bosses. I'm excited to bring you this week's sponsor, TripStreak, the smarter travel search. What I love about TripStreak is the ability to set your personal preferences to either have or avoid red-eye flights or have things like completely lie flat seats. So the next time you need to book a flight, check out tripstreak.com/travel like a boss.
Welcome to the Travel Like a Boss podcast, the radio show all about traveling like a boss by being your own boss. Stay tuned for weekly interviews featuring guests that have built their own online businesses. If you would like to have access to our entire back catalog, visit travellikeabosspodcast.com for instant access. And here's your host, Johnny SD.
Hey guys, it's Johnny and welcome to episode 168 of the Travel Like a Boss podcast. I'm here with Eric and Derek, the Flexer crew.
Hey Johnny, how's it going, man?
Hey.
Good. Dude, it's awesome to talk to both of you guys again and have you guys back on the show. Where are you guys nowadays?
We're in New York.
Yeah, that's New York City, man, for a little while.
Yeah, it's crazy. So where was the last time I saw you guys? I think with Derek, what was it, in Austin?
Either Austin or Chiang Mai. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a long time. And your episode, I think the last one you were on was episode 99, I think, with Derek. That was called Moving to Austin, Teespring, Saving Taxes, all that good stuff. And then Eric, I saw you in...
Yeah, I think it was in Bali in April. Yeah, I think April before you went to Barcelona. We hung out at my villa for a couple of days.
Yeah, that was dope. I like that one a lot. And that was... I think you've been on episode, I think both of you guys have been on episode a couple of times. That was episode 135 is when you first quit your kind of New York corporate job and moved to Chiang Mai. And then 158, I believe, was the one we recorded in Bali.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was like 6 months apart from each other. So I think Derek's been on a few times as well with you on your show.
Yeah. And that's been fun. It's been a long time. And you know what? I think the kind of coolest thing is how much progress people make with their business and creating new, like, cool, you know, just kind of cool things every time I talk to them. I think when I talk to my friends back home and I say, oh, what have you been up to? And when they say, oh, you know, same old, they actually mean the same old, they probably, you know, they're probably working the same job still, kind of going to the same places doing the same things. And like with us, like the last time I saw Derek was, what, just like 2 years ago? And now, you know, you've created this, this huge new product, like from scratch.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a long and exciting and weird journey.
Yeah. He's being humble, Johnny. He's been on this crazy adventure for 2 years, creating his own product from scratch that he thought of because of his travel. So he's really, I mean, I only met him back in October of last year. And was blown away when I first talked to him, but his journey to get to where he is today with the Flexer and what he's been doing is just insane.
So how did the two of you guys meet?
So we met in Pun Space, a co-working space in Chiang Mai. He walked in with this sumo me, like a giant sumo wrestler on his t-shirt, and was like, "What? How was the sumo me conference?" And then we got talking, and he actually bought my Amazon FBA business, and we worked together for, I think, maybe 4 months, 6 months before we got involved with other projects together.
Yeah, exactly. I was in Austin for the Sumo.me conference, which is AppSumo.com, Noah Kagan's first conference that he hosted in 2016. This is right after I quit Budweiser. And I went there before I flew to Chiang Mai. And they gave out these t-shirts that have a giant face of a sumo wrestler and tacos on it, because that's a part of the brand of AppSumo. And I was sitting there and Derek kind of interrupted my flow, which is probably the best interruption of the past year. So that's kind of how we connected.
I like it. Why the tacos?
It's just, I think, an Austin thing. And tacos are huge in Austin. And Noah loves Austin, the founder of AppSumo. And he talks about it all the time. If you go to a site like okdork.com, everything is tacos. It's like his theme of life is tacos.
You know, I like tacos a lot too. That's actually the one thing I miss the most when I travel, because it's so hard to get good Mexican food anywhere outside of California and Mexico. And I guess Austin, I think I would have to eat more tacos there to be able to really compare. Derek, have you been to both?
Austin and what was the second one?
And California or Mexico?
I think California Mexican food is better than Austin. I'm from San Francisco and I lived in Austin for a year and a half, I think. But I think the tacos are better in Austin, but everything else, burritos and nachos, are better in California.
Well, what's funny is tacos in LA are way better than the tacos in San Francisco. But San Francisco has, as you said, better like burritos and better Mexican food in general. So I'd be really curious if we put LA tacos head to head with Austin tacos, who'd come out on top.
You should do a video, Johnny. You should do another one of your Facebook videos on it. I know that we won't get anywhere close to decent tacos in Thailand. So next time you're in the U.S.
Well, they've actually finally opened up a taco truck in Thailand, in Chiang Mai. Have you guys been to it?
I haven't.
Yeah, it's called Rap Master for whatever reason. And they're not, you know, I mean, here's the problem with tacos or Mexican food in general is there are no Mexicans outside of Mexico and like some parts of the U.S., like California and Texas. And there are, you know, the reason why there's decent Chinese food around the world is because there's Chinese people everywhere. And so we really need to just encourage more Mexican people to travel and open businesses because I want their food.
Johnny, I think you're like the total opposite of the majority of people in the United States currently when it comes to the spreading of Mexicans. But I would agree with you wholeheartedly on that statement.
Yeah, 100%. And actually, so I had a taco just a few days ago here in Kiev, Ukraine, at a taco truck actually called Obama Tacos.
That's insane. That's incredible. Yeah, I bet you want to find one that says Trump Tacos.
Well, there's Trump beer out here that says, like, I think the tagline was like, "Divided States of America, proudly brewed in Mexico."
That's great.
Yeah, it's nice.
Hey, Johnny, how long have you been in the Ukraine?
I've been here for, I think, 2 weeks in total now. And
oh, nice.
Our buddy Chris Lil is coming out here next week to join.
He's leaving Bali and coming out to Ukraine?
Yeah, finally. He got sick of getting scammed for $500 out of his ATM every other week.
How do you like it there?
In Ukraine? It's great. It's like the final frontier for Europe. It's the only place I would think left in the world where it looks like Europe, you know, and you see people that look, you know, European, but everything feels like it's a culture that is kind of between the 1940s to like 1980s. And like, it just feels like it's a time capsule in the world.
Wow.
So basically you almost feel as if you were around Europe or the US 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. And the prices reflect that too.
That's great. Now, what does it cost like compared to Chiang Mai? I'm really curious. I've thought about going, but I've never pulled the trigger.
Well, some things are way cheaper and some things are way more expensive. It's weird. So Kiev itself is more like New York or Bangkok than it is Chiang Mai because it's a huge city. And the benefits is, you know, you have everything a huge city has like a great metro, has a ton of, you know, restaurants and clubs and, you know, pretty much like whatever you would want. It's just a big city. There's a smaller city called Lviv that is very similar to Chiang Mai, I would say, in look and feel. It's like their old capital, their old city. And things that, I would say that place would be a better comparison. And housing is going to be a little bit more than Chiang Mai. And it's not as easy to find monthly rentals. I think Chiang Mai is a blessing where it's probably one of the only places on earth you can just walk up into a building and say, I want to rent a nice furnished apartment for a whole month. So here you have Airbnb and then you'd have to like sign a 6 month contract. And I would say, you know, for like a decent, let's say a studio, it would be about, you know, $300 or $400 a month. So a little bit more than Chiang Mai, but not a lot. And then like a one bedroom would probably be in Lviv would probably be about like $500 or $600. But here in Kiev, if you were renting an Airbnb, it's going to be $1,000 to $1,300 a month. If you want to live like super center, like, you know, lower west side or lower east side kind of Manhattan.
Nice. Is that the area you're in?
Yeah. I am in the one, like basically like this, the center. I mean, I walk 5 minutes in any direction and I'm anywhere, you know, anyone wants to meet up. So nice. It's kind of one of those things where I'm in a smaller, it's not even a studio. It's like a studio with a separate kitchen. So it doesn't feel as much like a studio, but for about $1,000 a month, I'm staying here versus last week I was staying in an Airbnb that was like, it was probably only a 20-minute walk from the center, so it was still really close. And the only reason why I didn't keep it was because it was a huge hill and I was just exhausted going up every single day. But that place was what you would pay in New York. Like, I can't even explain how nice it was. It looked like something some super baller New Yorker would live in. Like, you know, and they would, it's owned by some French woman. It had this huge bedroom, a separate huge living room with three couches in it, had like another, like a second bedroom that wasn't even being used, had a nice kitchen, had two patios and balconies. And that was about $1,000 a month off of Airbnb. So it's definitely possible to live like a super nice lifestyle here where you have a private driver or you have an Uber, you eat at like, you know, 4 or 5 star restaurants every night. You like just ball out and you can live really, really well for, I would say, about $2,000 a month.
That's crazy. Nice. Yeah. That's crazy. It seems like a great place to go after Chiang Mai during burning season.
Oh yeah. I think my new plan is spend maybe like 3 to 6 months here, either in Ukraine or Europe in general, and then spend like the winter, you know, 3 to 6 months in Chiang Mai.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. Can't wait to see you again, bro, in like 2 months in Chiang Mai.
I know. Be fun. So what are you guys spending out in New York?
Cost wise? Yeah. Oh God. I don't even want to look at my credit card statements, Johnny, but I would have to say that in a given day in New York City, if we're going out to eat every day, I'm probably blowing anywhere between $30 and $50 a day just on food. It's a miracle right now that I don't have to pay anything for a living. I'm kind of crashing at Derek's place. it's a new like co-living location in New York that they haven't filled yet. So each apartment has 3 rooms. You're renting an individual room in the apartment. So you get two people that you may not know that you come in, but the benefit is you only have to stay 3 months up front. So Derek's only has to stay at this apartment for 3 months, and then it's month to month. And the other great thing is, since it's so new, one of the rooms in Derek's apartment is currently empty. So I'm kind of crashing on that bed currently, which is saving like $1,700 or $2,000 a month until that goes away. But just in food, travel, transportation, getting around, it's probably easily $2,000 to $3,000 without rent a month to stay out here.
Wow. Yeah. So if you were actually paying rent on that place, you'd be spending $3,700 to $4,000 a month.
Yeah, it maybe even closer to $5,000. Yeah, so super expensive. This is one reason I left this place when you first met me on the other podcast a year ago. Where I'm only in New York for July-ish timeframe. We're going to some conferences. Derek and I launched our Kickstarter Tuesday, the 11th, which is coming up in a few days from when we're talking right now. So really, really focused on that aspect. But yeah, it's super expensive, man.
Well, I'm sure there's a reason why you guys went to New York. I know, Derek, you were kind of talking about just like kind of being in the kind of like the mix of things where all the other entrepreneurs would be, where the startups would be. How's that kind of worked out for you?
I think it's worked out both good and not good at the same time. I joined a much larger company for a few months to have that learning experience. So they're in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And yeah, it's been really good. I've learned a ton of stuff that I think I just wouldn't have had the opportunity to learn in the digital nomad space, I guess. But at the same time, I think what I've realized is I want to be in the Silicon Valley sphere. So I think I'll be in New York for a little longer, and then I'm going to move back to Asia to work on getting the Flexer manufactured. That's the product that we're doing Kickstarter, to work with Eric on a couple other projects. And then I think we're going to do a programming bootcamp together. But yeah, I think at some point I'll end up back in San Francisco Bay Area.
I like it.
Yeah, Johnny, he kind of went through an accelerated version of my corporate life over these past 6 or 7 months. So I spent almost 6-7 years in the corporate world learning about that space. Derek accelerated that 80-20 into about 7 months in his current position. So when I come here, it's completely different hanging out with Derek in New York compared to Chiang Mai. Obviously, you know, Chiang Mai, everybody is available most of the time, can go get soup or go to the gym or hang out and make their own schedule. Derek reminds me currently of my friends that are impossible to get a hold of because they're always busy, always working. They can't take time off, that kind of mentality. So I'm excited for a few months from now when New York is no longer its home base.
Yeah, I remember the last time I went to New York and I wanted to meet a friend for dinner. We said, oh yeah, let's meet up after work. You know, what time should I make the reservation for? And I was thinking after work meant 5:30 or 6, you know, maybe 6:30 the latest. And he said, make it for 9. Just in case.
Yeah, man. It's totally like that. Like Derek probably gets out currently at 6:30. By the time we meet for dinner, it'll be 7:30 if we're lucky. And he's trying to get out early so we can work, right? So that's not even normal time for him. And then we'll eat and we won't start working on the Kickstarter together until about 9 o'clock. And then we go until 2 or 3 in the morning before he has to pass up to get back to work at 9 the next morning. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's crazy. And then I'm working all day, like in juice shops and coffee shops. And people are like, oh, Eric, you're in New York. Let's hang out. And I'm like, sure, why not? Let's do lunch. Oh, I can't do lunch. Okay, let's hang out Thursday. Oh, I can't do Thursday. Oh, let's hang out Saturday. Oh, I have this plan. I'm like, okay, just tell me when you want to hang out because I'm free to meet up with you at any point.
Yeah, and it's crazy, but it's one of those things where I feel like in New York, the reason why people are so busy is because their time is so valuable, as in every – if you break it down, like every hour of your day costs you X amount to even be in New York. So if you're not making the most of it, you're just screwing yourself. It's like the exact opposite of LA or Thailand where – there are plenty of people who are completely unemployed, but they just kind of skate by and it's fine.
Yeah, completely. It's total opposite. You need to be grinding here because if you don't have the money, you won't be able to afford anything. It's very difficult to get a place at a reasonable rate. And you at some point you break down how much am I earning per hour and how much am I losing per hour, because that's basically what it comes down to when you're in this environment.
Yeah, and I think that's actually kind of a big plus of being in a place like New York is it forces you to grind, it forces you to hustle, it forces you to work hard. And I understand why there's a lot of people who don't want to stay in Chiang Mai full time because you can get sucked into this easy life where you're just spending a grand a month and you're living, you know, doing everything you want to do. And you're like, well, why should I put in those extra 4 hours and why should I, you know, work from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. on a side project or on my passion project or on a new business when I don't, you know, I don't really need to. I can just chill.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I would say that in general, people in New York are super ambitious and also really open to connecting. So I really enjoyed going to different events and meeting people and just saying, hey, let's grab coffee, let's grab lunch. So being in New York has been really good for networking. I've met a lot of great contacts, great other entrepreneurs who I think hopefully I'll stay in touch with for a long time.
Yeah, I like that. So how did that? I'm curious. How did that compare to going to networking events or meetups in Austin?
So I think the velocity in Austin is much lower, and what I mean by that is in Austin there's one main. There's the Internet Marketing Party, which happens once a month. Which is like the main big party for like the digital entrepreneur community. And then there might be another event here and there, but there's not that much happening in terms of events. Versus in New York, there's probably 4 or 5 competing events every night. So if you wanted to fill your schedule with just meeting other people, you will never run out of cool things to do. So I think, yeah, there's just a lot more volume here, I guess.
Yeah, because there's so many freaking people there.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, you know, I think that's cool that you went there, that you went to all these events, and I almost kind of feel like it's probably going to reset yourself and giving you some motivation to, and also the contacts to be able to do something even bigger and greater. But I also think it was really cool that we all met in Chiang Mai at Pun Space, at the co-working space.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Johnny, I met you at Pun Space. And I think at the exact same week and time is when I met Derek. Mm. This all happened around October, November-ish, when we all – well, you and Derek were friends before that. But like when I became friends with you, Johnny, and then I became friends with Derek. And now Derek and I have been – I mean, I put a YouTube video out interviewing Derek 8 months ago at Pun Space, which is like my best YouTube video. And to look back 8 months, now that I bought his business, I've been building his business – we are potentially, I bought 80% of the business, so he's still a partner. We're potentially going to flip that. We have some like offers coming in to buy that business after I bought it. And then we connected so well on that business that he had this great idea around the Flexor pull-up bar that he almost and I'll let him tell the story later, but almost sold and just got rid of the idea. And we were able to connect and work together while he took a corporate job to take it to the last level to launch the Kickstarter. And that all happened in Chiang Mai, Thailand, in Pun Space, right next to each other, basically at the same table.
I love that. And it kind of really just shows that even though Chiang Mai is a place where a lot of people go as kind of newbies when they're first starting out, a lot of people are, you know, just their goal is to be able to make $1,000 a month and kind of just get by. I think it's actually, it could be much more than that. And it's really shown that the people that were there, let's say, you know, a year, two, 3 years ago, it's almost like they've leveled up or they've graduated to the next step. And you are, you know, Derek and Eric, I think you guys are really kind of the first people who are creating like a real, like revolutionary, like game changing product that I've met from Chiang Mai. I think a lot of people have, you know, virtual businesses. A lot of people have small, you know, small products like FBA products where they're just rebranding something, or they're dropshipping an existing product. And, you know, people are making money, you know, doing e-commerce or selling things online. But I think the Flexer is probably one of the first products where, you know, it's like completely freaking different that you actually went through the process. And I'm actually very curious, like, you know, how do you actually create a completely different product that did not exist? Like, cause this isn't like a rebrand of an existing pull-up bar. Like you've basically broken down and said, put the existing pull-up bar and said, we want to completely redesign this to be foldable. It's almost like, you know, you're saying, you know, yeah, I see there's existing skateboards out there, but I want to make a foldable skateboard. Like how do you even go through that process?
So I guess it starts with the idea. The idea came because I traveled a lot and I lived in cities like San Francisco where the dollar per square foot is so high that, you know, you're often renting really small apartments and having a large pull-up bar that you can't take apart or you can't really put anywhere is just not practical. And as a traveler, every time I went to a new city, I had to either find a new gym or just break my workout routine and not be able to continue my workouts. So from a couple different fronts, I wanted a product like this to exist and it didn't exist. So I started exploring, number one, so I had the desire in the beginning, and then I wanted to get some metrics to prove that this can actually be a business. So I researched how much sales the different pull-up bars are doing on Amazon, wanted to make sure that it wasn't all dominated by one big player, and that, you know, even if we get into number three or number four, we can still do decent volume. And when the numbers looked really good, I sort of decided that, okay, let's take this forward. So how I actually got the product made was how I'd imagine a lot of other digital nomads also get things made. They just hired out a lot of the different parts of the projects because I definitely don't have any industrial design or mechanical engineering skills. So I went on Upwork or Elance at the time, hired five industrial designers to come up each with three different ideas for how you would do a foldable pull-up bar. So I got 10, 15 ideas back, selected the best one, picked the best designer, you know, paid everyone, I think, somewhere between $50 to $100 just for their ideas. It was like not asking them to fully develop it. Found the best designer from the group, gave him, you know, the specs and the idea, and then worked with him on developing the product. It probably costs maybe like $3,000. We did two rounds of designs. He did one round of design. We prototyped it with a prototype shop in China. And then the bar was not – it didn't work at all. So we had to go through another round of designs, another round of prototyping.
Wow, that's crazy. So yeah. Wait. So the first prototype, when they gave it to you, it just didn't work. It didn't fold or it didn't hold weight? What was wrong with it?
It would come apart. So you could – what I wanted was a single piece pull-up bar. So you unfold it, you put it in the door, it's ready to go, and then you fold it up and it's all in one piece. The other unit actually broke apart into multiple pieces, which wasn't what I wanted.
Yeah, and I think that would be annoying because then you'd probably lose a piece or like you have to try to figure out how to put it back together.
Exactly.
And that's the main problem with the current solution, right? You get this bar and you have to assemble it yourself. And then once you assemble it, if you want to take it apart, you have to unscrew it, take it apart, and reassemble it later. So most people end up just throwing it in their closet or in the corner of the room where it takes up space. And Derek at the time, he wanted something where you take it out of the box, you can start using it, you fold it back up, you can put it back in the box, you can put it in a backpack, you can put it in a small travel carry-on wherever you need to bring it to the next place, or to store it in a closet, a drawer under the bed, but it takes up so little space that it's easier to use, that you don't forget about it, that you remember that it exists and you can continue to work out, and you can bring it anywhere so you can continue your routine. And that's what is brilliant about the current design.
Yeah, I think that's cool. I like that a lot, because I had one of those big bulky pull-up bar things in college, and I guess technically you could unscrew it all and take it apart, but that never even occurred to me because it would be such a pain in the ass to do so that it's like, you know, I mean, like an IKEA desk, I guess you could technically take it apart, but nobody's actually going to do that.
Yeah. When you move, you're just going to go buy another IKEA desk and leave the one you have at your house there or on the side of the street because it's cheaper to do so. So yeah, completely.
Okay, so I like it. So how pissed were you like when you got that first one back? And because did you ask them to have it all be in one piece and they just sent you, you know, something completely different, or like how did that mix up happen?
It was a combination of things. I think the design wasn't quite what I wanted, but like it looked good on paper. Also, the manufacturer didn't quite make it according to specs either. So I think it wasn't supposed to fall apart, or you were supposed to like take it apart and then fit it back together into the folded up form instead of like just folding and unfolding it into a different form. But it just wasn't quite working properly, so it ended up unfolding or ended up coming apart. But yeah, I was a little bit disappointed when I got that back. I was really hoping that we would get it, you know, on the first go. And at that point, we've been working on it for a few months, so I was like, oh man, we have to do this again.
Yeah, because I can imagine that's like a huge time waste to have to, you're going to go back to the drawing board. Did you have to go with a different manufacturer, or, you know, did they have to just remake the whole thing? Like, how much more time did that take to do another reiteration?
So one interesting thing about this project is a lot of it was actually, it didn't actually take a lot of my time in the beginning. So I would put a project up on Upwork and say, hey, I need 5 people to do this. And then it would take a week, and then I'd get the projects back, and then I'd pick the guy and say, all right, can you do this design? And he'd say, yes, give me 6 weeks. And then I wait 6 weeks, he gets it back, and I go to the manufacturer and say, can you do this? They say, yes, give us 2 months. So there's a lot of just, you know, sporadic work periods followed by long periods of just waiting for things to happen. But yeah, when I got the prototype back, my reaction was, great, we're going to have to, you know, wait another 3 months before we will know if there's something here.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think that makes a lot of sense on why it was a good idea for you to have an actual job while creating this. And because even if you wanted to work on this, you know, full time every single day, there's those waiting periods where there's nothing to do.
Yeah. I mean, unless you're a industrial designer yourself and you can, you know, bend the metal and 3D print your own prototypes. But yeah, if you're hiring it out to people in other countries, it's hard to work on it full time.
Do you know, Johnny, one thing I find really funny is a lot of people, when they imagine entrepreneurs, they always think that these projects that they work on they're working on them for 18, 20 hours a day, nonstop for years before they launch, especially a project like this. Something like a software company or a Silicon Valley company, yeah, there's definitely people grinding for that long. But if you look at people that are launching FBA businesses, drop shipping stores, building a product from scratch, many of these elements which require other third parties' involvement, there's days and weeks of time you can't do anything. You know, you're just waiting. You're just waiting for hours on end. Even when I launched my Airbnb business, we have to wait for the furniture to come. We have to wait for leases to be signed. We have to wait for people to in the other party to take care of documents. You know, there's just days where you're just sitting there. So it's actually, I think, a misunderstanding that every single entrepreneur effort that you go after is a constant grind and struggle for months or years on end, and then all of a sudden it's successful. It's actually usually much longer drawn out than that. And things like patents, lawyer documents, LLC creation, making sure we get our documents and designs back from our industrial designer, making sure that we get graphics back for our Kickstarter page, you know, that all has time associated with it, right? So there's always going to be gaps in that experience, and it's not just a hustle.
That makes sense. So actually on that, are you worried that, you know, you've spent all this time and money designing a great product, and then some guy from, you know, in China is just going to rip you off and start selling a knockoff version once it's successful?
Yeah. I mean, having been a private label Amazon seller myself, I think I'm intensely familiar with that space. I think no matter what we do, people are going to try and, you know, knock off the product. I feel pretty good about the protections we have in the United States and in China. So we have a utility patent and a design patent in the United States in the works. And then we have two other patents in China that are in the works as well. That doesn't mean that, you know, people aren't going to try and copy us anyway, but it does mean that we can get other listings taken down on Amazon. If people are trying to do like an AliExpress dropshipping via Facebook ads, we can get their Facebook ads taken down. We can have shipments stopped from China from leaving. It still means, you know, someone could take the designs and like sell them in Europe maybe, or you know, we're not completely protected, but I think I feel pretty good about, you know, protecting both our manufacturing front and our distribution fronts. But yeah, learning to navigate the legal logistics of how to protect the patent or protect the product as fully as we can, while also not incurring, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in legal costs has definitely been a little bit of a challenge to balance.
Yeah. And Johnny, I've personally received multiple cease and desist letters for products that I've attempted to sell that I didn't know there was a patent for. And a lot of the companies in the US, whether it be Amazon, Shopify, and others, will stop listings and stores from selling products that are protected. And on top of that, if these sellers don't stop selling, if we send a cease and desist, we can pursue them legally with the patents when they come into hand. And if they make $1 million in revenue over a 12-month period, they will have to pay us that revenue for not stopping. So that is, we've been putting these protections in place and working with our lawyers, making sure that this is a product that can go for 20 years under our name unless we decide to sell the rights. So yeah, completely with the new world and environment that we're in, it's going to be crazy. We're going to have to do a lot of monitoring. There's a lot of elements that we're going to have to take care of, but I think we're in a good spot right now.
You know, what's crazy is this is exactly what people have been talking about when they say things like, you know, Amazon FBA is getting oversaturated, or e-commerce in general, there's, you know, so many people on it. And everyone says you have to level up. You have to create a real business and a real brand around it. And this is exactly what they mean. You know, they mean instead of just selling, you know, like, let's say you could have went the easy route. You could have just private labeled another pull-up bar. Maybe marketed it differently, had better photos, had given it a different name. But at the end of the day, it would just be another generic product that everyone else could just copy and just, you know, price compete with you. And you guys took it that next step and said, you know what? We're going to build a unique product with unique benefits that's different and patentable.
Exactly. And if you go back to what you said about the foldable skateboard, Johnny, earlier in the episode.
That's my idea, by the way. Don't take that.
if you take that idea, right, and let's say one of your followers has done drop shipping or Amazon FBA, they have a lot of the skills already to take that next step, right? They know how to market. They know how to sell on these marketplaces. They know how to make sure that they bring in customer reviews, that they have the right copy, the right imagery, and the right ads driving to those listings. So they have the marketing side down, the supply chain side down. They know what they need to do. Now, oh, great, I have this foldable skateboard idea I want to do. How do I get industrial designers to help me with this? And then once you get your prototype complete, it's going to China to the same manufacturers that are selling to FBA businesses and working with them to ultimately take your product to a mold and then mass produce. So you're just adding a new step, a new layer into your process that you already know that you then can patent and turn into a real business. So by doing Shopify dropshipping or by doing Amazon FBA, you're already learning everything you need to learn from a sales perspective. All you're doing now is adding the product layer on top of that, which is just the next level of learning you need to do and to level yourself up.
And I think the one thing I'd add to that is that, number one, I think it's much less expensive than people think it is. To go from idea to prototype for our product was less than $10,000. But this is a product that has both injection molded plastic and bent steel in it. I think, you know, some products that come to mind where people have taken an existing idea and made it a lot better for really cheap. Like someone made placemats that had trivia on it or maps on it, right? Or you can take those laser etched coasters and do a different design, right? Like you can create a new product from scratch for, I would say, less than $1,000 or $2,000 and be protected from other people knocking off your idea. I think especially on FBA, trying to just do like a knockoff Me Too product, it's really difficult today. But if you're willing to spend just a little bit of money on innovating your product and creating a little bit of intellectual property protection for yourself, I think that's a much better way to go.
I love it. I think that's a great point that you guys brought up, is a lot of people are thinking, oh man, I missed the FBA train, or I missed the dropshipping train, or I missed this, you know, poor me. I think two things is, one is it's never too late to jump in, because you can always just do things a little bit better, a little bit differently than everyone else. And secondly, even if you end up, you know, just making, say, a few grand from whatever business you get into, that learning experience you get from, you know, learning how the back end of FBA works, or learning how to build a Shopify store, to do creative marketing, to drive traffic, all these things are useful regardless of what next business you get in, especially if you plan on leveling up and, you know, really creating a big business and a big brand.
Completely. I completely agree with that. And you're adding new elements every time you do something like this. Now, okay, I know that I have this new product. How do I use Kickstarter to validate it and bring in money beforehand so I can produce it? How do I launch a funnel so I can drive Facebook ads before that Kickstarter, so I can then build an email list to drive people to that Kickstarter, right? So you're learning more and more and more and more every time you level up this way. And it's all because you have to, right? It's just in time learning. As Pat Flynn says a lot of times, don't try to learn everything. Don't try to understand every software, every marketing technique. But when it's time to do something, read, learn, and understand that as much as possible before you actually do it, within like a few weeks. And then you will build a new skill by just going through that process and actually activating against it, instead of just watching some videos and eventually doing it maybe. You're actually in the roots doing it. So every time you do something like this, launch a new product, start a new business, expand on your FBA experience, you're adding skill sets and skill levels that other people don't have. And you're doing it by doing, not by listening or reading.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's why every time people ask me what they should start with, I always tell them something like, you know, pretty basic. I'm like, you know, do some kind of e-commerce, either do FBA, dropship, or do something and just learn the skills. Even though I think deep down inside, I know that creating something like this, like an actual brand, a unique product, is better in the long run, because it can be a bigger business that can sell for more money. It's predictable. It's, you know, a real unique product that might change the world, change lives. All these things are great, but the thing is, if someone doesn't even know how to freaking resize an image or upload a product to Shopify, like they shouldn't be you know, diving in head first.
Exactly. I completely agree with that. And that, bringing back to Chiang Mai and the people around there, you have such a good environment to get your feet wet, and you can accelerate yourself so quickly in that environment and jump and level yourself up in months instead of years. So I'm completely aligned with you, Johnny. When it comes to making any suggestions to friends or doing any masterminds with new people, I always try to do those masterminds with those groups on something like FBA, because you can walk them through the steps. There's a lot of resources out there. They can do just-in-time learning. And then as they build those skills, bam, they have a fundamental background to do the next level like Derek has.
Yeah, I love it. You know, so I actually had a big argument with Ryan Daniel Moran on this podcast. I don't know if you guys know, he's been on the show episode 46. And for those who don't know who he is one of the biggest FBA sellers out there. I think he had the highest selling yoga mat on Amazon for the longest time, and he sold that for a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the kind of core beliefs that we had very different was, he kept talking about how, you know, people shouldn't even bother with low level skills like learning how to, you know, let's say like create a Shopify store or sell like small products, that what they should do is jump straight in, hire the best people that know how to do, hire someone to build the entire site for you, hire someone to do all the marketing for you, hire people to do all the things that you don't know how to do, and don't worry about learning it, because you should be focusing on the big picture of building the big brand. And it was a little bit harder to argue with him, because obviously he's super successful. But at the same time, you know, kind of what we were talking about, where it's for most people, I think they would benefit so much, like learning some of the basics yourself, doing it yourself, proving it to yourself that you can do it, maybe making, you know, some money on the way, a couple grand here and there, and then leveling up and saying, okay, I know how to do it myself, but now I'm going to hire I'm gonna hire people and really knock it out of the park.
Totally. So one recent example, as we were running our Facebook ads, ClickFunnels was totally just behaving very weirdly, like dropping email leads and like not running our split test correctly. And after like three or four technical problems, we were just like, screw this, we're moving to lead pages.
Yeah.
And we rebuilt the whole site in like 2.5 hours. And I think, you know, if we had had to go to a third party designer and say, hey, can you like rebuild this? And then he'd have to say, yeah, I'm busy, can you give me 2 days? Like, we would have lost hundreds of leads.
And thousands of dollars.
And thousands of dollars, yeah. And you know, we have a crunch timetable just a few days before getting the Kickstarter out the door. So yeah, I think being able to do stuff hands-on is definitely a great skill in a startup. I think the counterpoint would probably be if you're a dentist who makes 200K a year and you have 400K in the bank, then and you can just hire a whole team. Like, I think not learning the web design skills might be, you know, that might make sense. But I think for most people who are kind of starting from a level where they're building something from scratch, I think definitely having the hands-on experience is really useful.
Yeah, I definitely agree that at a certain level, you should just hire someone good to do it for you. But the argument that I had was that if, as a dentist that knows nothing about building a website, if you hire someone, you're probably going to get ripped off and you're probably not going to actually get what you want, because it'd be like somebody that, if someone knows nothing about how to build a website and they ask for certain things, they might not realize that either A, it's not possible. Second, it's not feasible. Or third, it's like not even a good idea to do. And because they're paying someone, they're going to, you know, happily take the hourly bill. But when they kind of have an idea of how to do it themselves, it's a lot easier to hire someone to do that job and say, okay, I know I can do it, but instead of me spending 3 or 4 hours doing it myself, let me hire someone. I can give them clearer instructions on what to do and, you know, kind of knowing the process.
Yeah, I agree. And Johnny, just going with what you said here, the fact that I know how to create a website myself, the fact that I know how to build a Shopify store, run an FBA business, do SaaS modeling for software service marketing. When I am hiring those people, I can communicate with them much clearer. When they have a concern, I can answer it much easier. When I'm putting a strategy forth, I have more detail for them to execute against so they execute better. It's just overall, when you step away from doing, but you know it, and you have that team, the team believes in you more because you know what the hell you're talking about. And you can get more done quickly. And like you said, you won't get screwed over because you know what it takes to get something done. And I think any real founder in Silicon Valley, in a SaaS world, in a software world, in an app world, if they have foundational elements, even if they're not the one coding every day, even if they're not the one putting your email automated sequence together, even if they're not the one buying the Facebook ads, they know what the hell's going on. They are going to be much more successful with their business than if they just have these people doing it and they're talking super high level and they can't really connect with their employees or contractors.
Yeah, I 100% definitely agree on that. And I think the reason why I'm so glad you guys came on this episode is I think this is kind of a big bridge between, you know, people who are thinking, okay, I can see myself starting a small kind of digital nomad business. I cannot see myself starting, you know, a big company or a big brand. And it almost kind of seems overwhelming. And what I think would be really cool is if people are listening to this episode in 2018 or 2019 and Flexer becomes this giant brand that you see, you know, all over, you know, the net, maybe even retail stores and in people's houses, and they can come back and listen to this episode and be like, wow, these guys were just digital nomads and they just, all they did was they took the baby steps and just kept moving forward into that next layer of skills. And it wasn't like they were just born, you know, entrepreneurs that just happened to get lucky. It was all like a steps.
Completely agree. It's all about believing in yourself ultimately, right? And taking a step after a step. And you never know what's going to happen, right? We've been running all these Facebook ads, getting a huge email list for Flexer launch on Tuesday. You know, we've never finalized or done a Kickstarter before, right? But we have done lead generation and we have done sales conversion and we have been in this space. So we could either hit a major home run come Tuesday with the Kickstarter, which would be incredible because we've taken all these steps over the past months to do that and been planning and hopefully all those plans come together. or you never know, it might not work out. You know, it might not work out. But does that mean we should kill the product? No. Does it mean that we're going to be unsuccessful? No. It just means we might have not approached a certain thing correctly, or we might actually hit a home run and be able to record all that, put all of our knowledge into learning for people on other podcasts. So we, and this is our whole life for many years. Like, we take our first step into FBA. We don't know if it's going to work. It ended up working. We sell a business, and then someone else is offering to buy it again. You know, you launch a drop shipping store like Derek did way back when, and having no clue if it's going to be successful, but taking the steps, learning and approaching it and leveling up, and then doing $600,000 in Teespring sales Derek did a few years ago. Once again, had no background in it, just took the leap of faith, and through all those continued to level up to get the confidence to be a stronger entrepreneur. So I think people don't realize that it's not instant. They only see the end result of all the work and steps a person has taken to grow as an individual, to get where they are, to change their mindset, to learn something new, to think about life and business differently, and allow themselves to have a higher risk tolerance to take bets that could or could not pay off.
You know what's crazy is, so in the 3 years that I've known Derek, I think we met like early 2014, and we did our first podcast together in July. So exactly 3 years ago, episode 43, that was when you first... That was when you created your first dropshipping store. And then the next episode, we talked about that, those 30K months you were doing on Teespring. That was episode 99. And that was, I think that was, you know, that was actually right at the end of 2015. So just like a year and a half ago, I've seen Derek go through more learning and more businesses than in like just 3 years than most people go in their whole lifetime.
Cool. Yeah. Not really sure how to respond, but yeah, totally. It's been really cool. I've known you, like when you met me, I was like a broke freelance writer who's, you know, like had a ClickBank product that wasn't making any money. And then, you know, you showed me how to do drop shipping, and then that store did pretty well right out the gate. And then, we've kind of been around each other's journeys for 3 years. So it's been really cool to share the journey with you.
Johnny, I think it's great because you have like a recorded archive of both Derek's journey and my journey now on your podcast. So you have Derek when he was a broke freelancer, to Derek when he's doing 30K on Teespring, to Derek launching this Kickstarter now. And you have me when I first leave the corporate world and move to Chiang Mai, and then me in Bali launching Airbnb and the other businesses that we're doing, and then us together now. So you have like a archive of our life, basically, in the entrepreneur digital nomad experience.
Yeah, I love it. I think like for people listening that just assume they can't do what you guys are doing because you guys are so far ahead, re-listen to those old episodes and you can hear like you guys are completely different in your like your mindsets, your knowledge base, what your goals are. I mean, and it's one of those things where I love having this podcast because not only does it kind of force us to sit down and like really just dive in deep and share all the knowledge that we've learned along the way and really kind of just reflect on it, but also for people following along, they can be like, wow, like these guys are just normal guys that just are following their passions, following their dreams, and just making it happen.
Yeah, completely. And do you know what else is great that's happened through this podcast is we have some of your listeners that just reach out to us, Johnny, and say, hey, We've heard you on Johnny's podcast. Is there any way we could help you or learn or meet up? And Derek and I are the type of people where we will almost meet up with anyone that reaches out, you know, especially if they're in the same city. And we get to meet amazing people from your audience that are trying to go after their dream to go and become a digital nomad or an entrepreneur. Actually, I believe one of your listeners actually reached out to us directly on Facebook and is helping us with the Kickstarter right now for free. He said, hey, I would love to come help and learn, be around you guys. So he's coming tomorrow to do like a 6-hour grind session as we get ready for the Kickstarter. And we are then going to help him with any of his ideas and expand on that and give him input. So it's a great community that you've built. And through the podcast, being able to see the growth of individuals like yourself, Johnny, Derek, and your listeners, we're starting to get information from your listeners on how they've kind of gone through their journey as they reach out to us.
Yeah, I definitely love it. I think my favorite thing is when listeners become guests and they start sharing, you know, all their stories about what they've done. So definitely everyone listening right now, if you guys want to take this full circle, start kind of working on your dreams and your passion projects. Let me know how it goes. And if we end up meeting in person somewhere and you guys have a, you know, interesting story with some kind of success, I would love to hear it and also have you guys on.
Yeah.
So tell me more about the actual like marketing plan for Flexer. Like, why did you guys choose Kickstarter? What have you guys done kind of pre-launch, and why is launching so important to just putting out into the market?
Yeah. So there's two reasons. Number one was I wanted to validate the market, make sure that, I mean, I think it's a great idea, but I wanted to make sure that other people think it's a great idea as well. And number two, I think this is a great way to just reduce the personal risk. In order to get a product like this into production, you know, we're looking at probably about $20,000 in plastic molding and tooling costs, and then the initial run of product and shipping. I mean, it's probably at least $50,000 to get the product out the door. So I could just fund it out of pocket, or like we could, you know, put together money or investors. But I think going to create a community and create a customer base right out the gate is just a more powerful way to go. And a lot of Kickstarter campaigns are able to go out to their initial backers and just have everyone leave a review on Amazon. Like the Kickstarter campaign Exploding Kittens, I think they did like $8 million in Kickstarter. Within the first week of launching on Amazon, they had 10,000 reviews. And they just went from no listing to like the top of the gaming charts in Amazon overnight, because they already had their customer base and just said, hey, everyone, go leave a review. So I think instead of us, you know, slogging our way up the top and like giving away free products to try and get reviews on Amazon, if we just sell, you know, 5,000 or 10,000 of these before we even list it on Amazon, I think that'll just make getting traction and getting, you know, rankings and revenue a lot easier once we do launch on that platform. And the goal is for us to use Amazon as like a proof point to then go to retailers and go and be able to sell in REI or Target or, you know, sporting goods stores. So that was kind of the thought process behind why we went with Kickstarter. So as far as the marketing plan goes, probably the biggest traffic channel that we're using is Facebook ads. That's a channel that is a strength of mine, having, you know, done a lot of them via Teespring and for other businesses. So right now we're... Our lead cost started off at like $8 a lead, but we've gotten it down to about $1.40 now by just testing. You know, we've probably tested 15 different versions of landing pages, maybe 30
photos of ads and what we're putting into the Facebook ad content itself. We've been testing all of those. As Derek said before, making sure our platforms are actually working, switching to lead pages from ClickFunnels.
Yeah, testing probably 30 different targeting groups, testing different platforms, so Facebook mobile, Facebook desktop, Instagram, and just kind of putting everything together until we find the highest converting one. And yeah, we've got our lead cost down to about $1.40 a lead. So the idea is, you know, we're probably going to spend close to $10,000 on Facebook ads before this even launches and just have a large email list that we're blasting it out to. We're also working with a few influencers, you know, paying people who have a large YouTube following to, like, we're actually going to bring the product to them, and they'll do like a workout video with the product in it. We're coordinating a few other people who have like Facebook followings or email lists or
our own email list from other products that we've done,
right,
or courses that we've put out. We've been reaching out to as well. We actually are starting to put a big list of potential Facebook groups like Unilad and Viral Threads and all these others that post videos on Facebook of really cool ideas. We're going to be reaching out to them when the campaign goes live and sending them a press kit with the video, imagery, and so on that they could use on their pages. And then also follow up with press in general, like local press from where I grew up and was born, for example, all the way up to anyone, Gizmodo, Lifehacker, any of those guys. Just drop really good press releases to everybody and hope that 1-5% picks them up and promotes them on our behalf. We also have different referral programs and stuff that we're working on. And also a couple agencies that run Kickstarter campaigns have reached out to us and asked, hey, can you call us? We'd love to partner with you to help with your Kickstarter. They've seen our Facebook ads. They like the video that we have out, and they want to partner with us to help this grow. So the foldable pull-up bar that we're building is we're trying to approach Flexer from multiple angles to really drive on Tuesday the 11th, a solid foundational kick to our Kickstarter, which will hopefully drive a organic adoption by Kickstarter.com that we can get ultimately a 50 to 60% of the people that buy Kickstarter being organic Kickstarter buyers that see it on Kickstarter.com, and the rest is traffic that we drive to the site.
I love it. And at first, you know, when people hear, you know, like they hear your plan, they're thinking, man, you're going to spend $8 to get an email address for someone to buy, you know, maybe buy your Kickstarter, you know, product that starts at just $25. And, you know, like this, so there's no possible way that could be profitable. And even when you got the lead values down to just over $1 per Facebook lead, I think in a lot of people's mind, they're still thinking, like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, it's not like they're buying the product yet. You're just getting an email address to somebody who is potentially interested in buying this, but there's no guarantee they're going to buy it. And even if they do, that's still a lot of money to try to drive a sale. But what is kind of like the big plan behind that? Is every single like email, you know, really worth way more because they might share it with friends, or like, how does that work?
So the thought process is that for people who were paying to acquire the customers that we're running Facebook ads for, we're not really expecting to make any money off of it. I think we're basically expecting to break even. But if we can drive, you know, $40,000 worth of sales and break even on that, that'll build the credibility and velocity to allow us to get the sales from Kickstarter and just kind of from organic sales that'll give us the sales that'll actually generate the profits.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. So that's kind of higher level thinking. You're like, well, I got to get the ball rolling. Kickstarter's a great platform, but only if other people are already buying it. You know, people want the social proof, but people also want like to, you know, things only go viral once they go viral. Like there's kind of almost nothing before that, where it's either going to be a huge success or it's going to be like a trickle down small thing where it might not even be worth doing.
Yeah. And the way we've set it up, Johnny, is when we push people to travel, pullupbar.com, basically from any of these sites, we're getting those lead captures. We're getting that information. We're getting all these people. And yeah, it might cost a ton of money, but when we ultimately drive that traffic to Kickstarter, Kickstarter will recognize that. Kickstarter will see, oh man, there's people coming to this store. There's people coming to Flexer's product and buying it. It's accelerating. We should promote it as well. And that's where we start getting more payoff in our conversion that we got from Facebook or any other leads that we capture will actually decrease the conversion cost because the organic will start coming in. So if you don't do this, and if you don't do any type of marketing yourself beforehand, people just believe that they can put up a product on Kickstarter and it's going to like go viral and be brilliant and automatically be picked up by everybody. That never really happens. The same way that if you launch a YouTube video, unless you have a strong subscriber following, you're not going to go viral unless you get outlets to promote it, blogs to promote it, influencers to promote that video. Virality is not natural. A lot of it's cooked, you know, in some way, whether it's subscriber bases or you're driving leads to a page like on Kickstarter to get that paid conversion first before you start seeing the organic. And we might be at $1.70 a lead, but we're predicting that it's going to cost us $20 to get a single person to buy a Flexer. So our leads might be $1.40, $1.50, $2, but we don't expect all of them to convert. We actually put them through this process. When someone goes to the URL, to the website, they will enter their email, they'll see the video, and then we put them through something we call a soap opera email sequence, which is basically for 7 days, once they type their information in travelpullupbar.com, they will get a sequence that tells them about Derek's journey and his story of the Flexer. So parts of it that you heard on this podcast, him coming up with the idea, how he came up with the idea. And then we every day tell him a little bit more. Like one of the days we talk about how he got frustrated and almost literally sold the idea to someone for a few thousand dollars instead of continuing the patent. And then how he met me and how we became partners. So we take all these people on a journey so they get closer to our product and closer to us. So when we launch on Tuesday, hopefully 10% of them will convert, 15% of them will convert into buyers, give us that momentum we need from Kickstarter to recognize us and provide organic traffic. So that's kind of how everything's thought about when we think about our launch. We need to spend money to make money at the end of the day. And our conversion rate that will cost less and less as we get more and more from Kickstarter. So how do we make sure they want to promote us?
It's crazy because it's kind of very similar to the idea that the rich get richer and the poor kind of stay poor. But I think the difference is it's you guys started with zero audience, as in zero people who wanted to buy the Flexer, and you guys are just hustling and grinding your way to, you know, to that point where then, you know, you guys can be at a point where, you know, it's like self-driving momentum. It's like you guys are like, you know, doing it the hard way, collecting snow to build your own snowball and walking it up the hill. So at some point, you know, the snowball can just roll and gain its own momentum.
Exactly, man. Exactly. We don't expect a ball to be formed at the top of the hill by itself and for someone to come along and push it. We have to do that ourselves, and we shouldn't expect anyone else to. So we've been hustling for the past basically month, focused just on this Kickstarter, just to make sure that we can get that momentum. And we're hoping at this point, we're 2 days out, that we've built some sort of momentum through our Facebook group, through our landing page that I just mentioned, through the Facebook ads, through the conversations you and I are having and other influencers are having, and the posts that Derek put on Facebook, for example, and I put on Facebook to our friends, just literally taking any energy that we have and pointing that energy towards this campaign. And I think, I mean, at this point, it's kind of like we roll the dice, you know, it's going to be Tuesday. We're going to bet on black and hopefully it lands there and we don't land on red.
Roll a $20,000 dice.
Yeah, we're rolling a $20,000 dice right now that it could go one of two ways. And we're obviously hoping for one way. But yeah, man, there's no guarantees to success to this. But I'll tell you one thing, even if we walked away where we have to find this money to build this ourselves after the Kickstarter because we don't raise as much as we potentially need, we learned a ton. And the amount of people that we talked to, the amount of phone calls we've had, webinars, discussions, masterminds, people that have added ideas, people that have added to our marketing campaign, people that have gotten excited about this product. Derek's Facebook post was his best Facebook post ever, basically, with over 300 likes, multiple shares, hundreds of comments. You know, when you get that excitement in your community, your friends alone, that drives you and brings the passion into this project even further. So we've got so much out of it, even if it doesn't go amazingly well, like we're hoping. Obviously, we're shooting for the stars. We can walk away and be like, shit, we learned a ton and this was an excellent process. And we understand how to do this again in the future and what we need to tweak. So I'm walking away in a month when this Kickstarter is done, happy either way. Hopefully it's with a nice big check that we can bring to the manufacturer and run thousands and thousands and thousands of Flexers to people around the world.
Well, I want to help support because first off, I'm a huge fan of bodyweight exercises and doing pull-ups. I've actually been doing my own pull-up challenge recently and I've literally been doing it as like my only workout for the last couple of weeks. So the next time I see you guys, I'm going to challenge both of you guys to see who can do more.
Yeah, man, I will accept your challenge 110%. And we need to put some money on the line, my friend, because we need some true motivation. Here, I'll do this. If you beat us, if you beat Derek or I in pull-ups, we will give you 3 Flexers right off the line when they come out. Our first run, you get the first 3 of them. And what do we get if we win, Derek? What do you think? We'll think about what we get, John, but you've already given us a ton. So if you beat us, you get 3 Flexers right off the line. You'll be the first one to get it wherever you are in the world.
Oh, I love it, man. And I'll definitely start training because I don't know if I could beat both of you guys, but definitely at least one of you guys. So you better step up your pull-up game. All right. So if people want to check out the product, where can they find it?
Just go to travelpullupbar.com.
I love it.
And that will lead you either to our landing page or directly to our Kickstarter.
It'll probably go directly to Kickstarter when you're listening.
When you're listening, probably directly to Kickstarter. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. And so they want to buy one. It starts super cheap why does it start so cheap and go up? Like how does that algorithm work?
So the vast majority of the sales will come in at the $49, which is like 40% below the price that we'll sell at retail once we launch. But we decided to sell 100 of them at $25 and then 200 of them at, I think, $29 and then another 200 at $35. The idea behind those is we want to build up momentum. Kickstarter cares more about the number of people backing your project than the amounts they're backing it for. Otherwise, anyone can just, you know, back $10,000 at their own project and get to the top of Kickstarter. What they really want to see is they want to see hundreds of people from different, you know, different kinds of accounts. And they just want to see momentum from different people backing your project. So what we wanted was we wanted to have a few lower price tiers to generate that momentum, to just get the initial backers and to get to the low tens of thousands of dollars so that when people come to the page, they see that, oh, wow, this has gotten funded. You know, they've raised $20,000 in the first day or whatever the amount is. That way, we just have more credibility and more momentum for when we're selling at the price that we want to sell, which is $49, which is still, you know, significantly lower than we're going to sell it for once the product is off the production line.
Exactly, Johnny. So if your listeners get to the Kickstarter page at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, they will be able to be one of the first ones to buy the Flexer at the $25, $29, $35 price. So if they show up at that time when it launches, or they go and join our Flexer group on Facebook, or even jump in our email list right now, they'll get information right when we launch. So they have a chance of getting those early numbers. But the $49 range is what we're extremely excited about, because it's 40% off our $79 that we'll be selling later on. It will be the value that really supports the business to allow us to manufacture and get these out as quickly as possible. But either way, it's a steal. And we're launching, like I said, at Tuesday at 11 a.m. So whoever there is early will be able to grab one of those early deals.
Very, very cool. And if anything, just go to the site and check out the video, because it's pretty cool. You know, it's something that I've always wished existed. So I'm glad that you guys are making it. I think that everyone in the world should do pull-ups. I think both men and women should do pull-ups. If everyone in the world could do 10 pull-ups, I think everyone would be healthier, happier, in better shape, look better, and just, you know, overall be able to just like enjoy life more just by doing so. And right before this, we actually started recording, I actually made sure to watch Eric do some pull-ups on the Flexer, because I've seen your promo video, and it was very cool. You know, you have all these like athletic models, you have all these like, you know, fit people doing it. But I was like, you know what? If this can hold Eric's weight, then I know it's legit.
Thanks, Johnny. yeah, man, I'm down to around 200 pounds, and it's definitely can hold me up and holds people up to 250-ish pounds, if not even heavier. That period. So it's definitely a stable machine, and yes, I can do pull-ups. And the only reason we didn't send Johnny one ahead of time is we actually only have that one prototype. So
it's because it costs us right now $2,000 each to make. So
yeah, Johnny's great, but we'll wait until we can get it down to a more reasonable cost. So we're actually taking that prototype around New York to our influencers, our friends. If Johnny was here, we would love to shoot a video with them, but it's not that simple. And the cool fun fact, Johnny, that video that Derek put together for the Kickstarter was actually shot all in Bali. So the pull-up bar, the Flexer, has been to Bali, has been to Chiang Mai, it's been to Shanghai, Guangzhou, and other parts of China. It's been to the Philippines, all around the U.S. This one pull-up bar has been traveling around the world for the past few months as we've created the content for it, found the suppliers and the manufacturers, and been promoting it. So it's a world traveler in itself already, which matches really well with Derek and I and the ultimate goal of the Flexer. We've kind of put it through thousands of miles already, which is really cool to be able to say.
I love that. That's actually super cool. I mean, that is like literally traveling like a boss.
Exactly. And we're glad when we make the claims that this is a traveling pull-up bar, we've actually done it already. So it is travel like a boss.
I love it. So if you guys want to pick one up, or if you guys just want to see the video of how it works, what it looks like, the folding mechanism, how it kind of folds up, I think it's pretty cool to watch. So check that out. That is what, travelpullupbar.com?
Yep, travelpullupbar.com.
And if for whatever reason you guys don't buy one, would it I noticed you guys have a pledge $1 or more button. Is that, does that help you guys? If, like, if someone just gave a dollar, would that help your Kickstarter kind of blow up and gain momentum?
Yeah, it helps a lot, actually. Just having more backers will help us in the Kickstarter algorithm. And if they back, you know, if they just do $1, they'll still get behind the scenes access and see, you know, I think the people who are listening to this podcast are the types of people who would want to know, how do you manufacture a product like this? And we're going to be sending a lot of updates, like videos from our factories and things that we're not going to send to the main email list that we will send to everyone who's backed the campaign. So even if they just back it for a dollar, I think they'll get a lot of value out of it.
It's probably the cheapest course ever.
Actually, I was going to say that, you know, I think half the people listening to this are going to be like, you know what? Maybe I can make myself some kind of a product, whether it's, you know, I'm gonna steal Johnny's idea and make that foldable skateboard, or they're going to think of their own idea and think, you know what? Maybe I'll take these tips that I've learned from these guys, you know, go through the kind of the same marketing structure and use Kickstarter as a platform. So if you guys have learned a ton from this podcast, if you learned some good marketing advice from these guys openly sharing their stories and, you know, all the kind of their secret marketing sauce behind it, and you want to, you know, spend a dollar on Kickstarter to help them, you know, please do so. Like, it's almost kind of like, this is, instead of me having a Patreon, this is, I'll send you guys to their Kickstarter and you guys can help kind of get this ball rolling. Cause I would freaking love it if I see Flexer everywhere. If I go to my friends' houses and I can do pull-ups with them, I think that'd be my goal. I want to be able to go to my friends' houses and have them always have some kind of pull-up bar. And especially because most of my friends travel, I would love for them to have a Flexer. So, you know, wherever we are in the world, we can do pull-ups together. So that is my goal. And to help get you guys there, not only, you know, will I, you know, donate some money to the Flexer, just get the ball rolling, but I encourage everyone here who's gotten a lot from this podcast and just wants to help roll the ball. If you guys aren't, you know, even if you guys don't buy one, just give a dollar. You know, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but I guarantee you that $1 donated to their cause is going to do more for their launch than pretty much anything else.
Exactly. Johnny, we really appreciate that. Anything is going to help us with the momentum. And you have some of our favorite audience members, period, in the world. They relate to us a ton. And we've built this for them. Like, you, when it comes to the fit of this product, your audience is exactly who we are and what we've been trying to build for ourselves over time. So I really appreciate you supporting us. And I'm excited to do that pull-up challenge with you, hopefully back in Chiang Mai, or if I head over to Ukraine beforehand. I'm really excited to bring the Flexer so you get to see it for the first time in real life.
I'm excited. So big congratulations on your launch. I'm going to try to get this podcast out on Tuesday, July 11th, which I don't know if you guys realize is my birthday.
Oh, sweet. Oh, wow. That's awesome, Johnny.
Happy birthday.
Well,
Happy birthday, man.
Thank you. I thought you were launching on my birthday just to help celebrate. That could just be a coincidence.
We were actually going to tell you on this podcast. Yeah.
I love it. So if you guys want to help support, check out travelpullupbar.com. And if you guys want to know more about Derek and Eric, check out those previous episodes of the podcast where they talk more about where they, how they came up in business and what they've been doing so far. And if you guys end up wanting to fly out here to Ukraine or to Thailand, check out our sponsor, tripstreak.com. Go to tripstreak.com/travel like a boss. And I'll see all of you guys next week. Peace out. Thank you for listening to the Travel Like a Boss podcast. If you want to hear more, including the bonus, how to choose the perfect niche episode, join our mailing list at travellikeabosspodcast.com. See you next week. And remember, if you want to travel like a boss, you need to be your own boss. So start your online business today and start living the lifestyle you've always dreamed of.